Welcome to the CSAU Research Podcast. This is a series of conversations about projects taking place through the Centre for the Study of African Economies at the University of Oxford. I'm Simon Quinn. I'm an Associate Professor at the Department of Economics and Public Policy at Imperial College Business School. And until last year, I was privileged to be Deputy Director of CSAE. Today, we're going to be talking about the project, an adaptive targeted field experiment, job search assistance for refugees in Jordan. And this was a project that was run in partnership between CSAE and the International Rescue Committee. When we talk about this project, we're talking about what I think is a really important policy question, namely, how is it that different kinds of policy can help refugees and other displaced populations? And we all know, sadly, that we live in a time when this is a really important issue for policy in a lot of different geographical settings. When we talk today about this issue, we're thinking about Syrian refugees and also local job seekers in Jordan. The labor market in Jordan is characterized by very low employment rates, at least by international standards, and employment rates among refugees are much lower than among Jordanians. So this is a project, as we're going to discuss, in which we think about the impact of three interventions that were designed to improve formal employment outcomes, both for Syrian refugees and for local job seekers. I'm really excited to be joined today by two of my co-authors on this project, Stefano Carrier, who's a professor in the Department of Economics at the University of Warwick, and Max Casey, a professor in the Department of Economics at the University of Oxford. Max and Stefano, thanks so much for joining me. It's great to be able to discuss this project again.
Hi, Simon. Thanks so much for having me on this podcast.
Thank you, Simon. It's really great to be here and to be able to talk about this project.
Maybe if I could start with you, Max. I mean, one of the things that I found fascinating working with everyone on this project is that this is an adaptive field experiment. And I learned a lot about this whole idea of adaptive experiments by working on it. And it's something that I actually think is one of the most exciting parts of this research paper, and hopefully something that will be relevant to a bunch of other researchers in this and other fields. So can I ask you, first of all, to tell everyone what an adaptive experiment is and how we implemented the adaptive experiment in this context?
So as you mentioned, we ran this study in the form of an adaptive experiment, and more specifically an adaptive targeted experiment. Maybe before we go there, let's back up a little bit and talk about what the purpose of running experiments is or what the goal is, because that really points us to why this might be a good idea and why this might be useful in many other experiments. Over the last couple of decades or so in development economics, it has become very standard to run randomized controlled trials, right? In a randomized controlled trial, you randomly assign different people to different treatment arms, as it's called, different policies. And then you see afterwards how things turn out, and you get hopefully a credible estimate of how effective these policies are. That makes perfect sense, I think, for a lot of cases. What it does is it runs the experiment in a way where the goal is to get precise estimates of how effective a policy is, and maybe precise statistical tests. But that might not be the only thing you care about, right? So getting precise estimates is not the same thing as informing policy choices. And it's also not the same thing as helping participants. So those are two rather different objectives. And when we want to pursue these other objectives, then we might need to run our experiment in a different way. And so maybe to illustrate that, kind of a very clear example might be clinical trials in medicine, right, where you have, say, a drug and a placebo, or maybe some standard treatment that you compare to a new treatment. And say you run such an experiment, and if you're like sticking to a standard RCT protocol, you just have like a 50-50 split between the two treatment arms, and you observe how well they're doing, and you just keep running with that until the end of the experiment. But now what might happen in such an experiment is maybe halfway through you realize that your new drug is killing everybody, which would not be very good. Or it might be that the new drug is kind of a miracle and it's curing everybody. And so you would want to use that information for the sake of your patient, right? You wouldn't just want to keep going with your fixed protocol, ignoring what you learned, and just use your patient as a means to an end. You want to help your patient. And so what that means is you might want to adapt over time. You might want to shift your treatment or your assignment to treatment towards the treatment arm to perform better. So if the new drug is curing everybody, then you want to assign the new drug more often as time progresses. Or if it seems to hurt people, then you might want to quickly shift away. And so that's kind of the core idea of adaptivity. And that's something that we implemented now in our experiment, which ran over a whole number of months. And in our experiment, the goal was to help Syrian refugees find jobs in the Jordanian labor market. In order to do that, we observed like four different treatments, and Stefano, I guess, will tell us more about those later. There were different information and cash and nudge interventions to try and help people find jobs. Over time, the idea was to shift treatment towards those interventions that were most successful at finding people jobs.
Yes, absolutely. No, thanks very much, Max. Maybe can I bring you in, Stefano, and tell us in brief about the different treatment arms? And then I want to go back to Max and think about how we implemented this in a way that tries to think about different subgroups. But let me hold off on that until we hear a bit about the treatments themselves.
So we had three interventions that we were interested in trying out in this project. One was a small unconditional cash grant, which we calibrated to cover the cost of job search for about a couple of months. So we had baseline data on how much people were spending on job search. And so we calculated an amount that people would spend in about a 2 month period. We know that a job search can actually be surprisingly expensive because people have to use transport and travel around town and have all sorts of expenditures that when you live on a very low income can actually make up a large share, a surprisingly large share of your budget. And so we try to support them in making these investments by making cash available upfront at the beginning of the search span. So cash is the first intervention. The second intervention was an information intervention where we basically try to coach people, to train people in presenting themselves to employers. Prior research that we've done with you, Simon, and other researchers in Ethiopia and South Africa and Uganda shows that job seekers' ability to convey their employability, their skills, their worth to employers is really a key ingredient to their success in the labor market. And so in the second intervention, job seekers who may not necessarily have been familiar with the new standards of the Jordanian labor market, because they were refugees, were basically trained in approaching Jordanian employers and presenting their skills and convincing them of their employability. That was the second intervention, the information intervention. And finally, we had a psychological or nudge intervention, which was really motivated by the idea, which is well documented, that job search is a very difficult and frustrating process, which requires you to sustain the motivation to search hard over a long period of time. So motivation is central to the success of job search, and people struggle to maintain high levels of motivation when they start getting rejection after rejection. So to help people maintain high levels of job search effort, we use the insights from the recent psychological literature as well as a recent trial in South Africa and devised a goal setting intervention where job seekers were encouraged to set themselves some job search effort goals. And then they would report on whether they attained those goals or not. They would be able to set other goals for the following week. So these were the three interventions: cash, information, and the psychological nudge. And of course, there was also a fourth group, a control group, that did not receive any of these three policies.
Thank you, Stefano. I remember a fascinating visit that you and I had with some of our partners from the International Rescue Committee, where we actually went from Amman up to the northwest of Jordan to Irbid and spoke to several refugees. And I think we both felt it was like fascinating and humbling to hear about the whole constellation of different challenges that these respondents were facing. And I think it's exactly as you say, partly it's about motivation, partly it's about understanding the labor market, partly it's about having the cash to actually access jobs. And I think that's, you're absolutely right. This is why we went for these three treatments in this context. Max, we opened by talking about targeting. Can I come back to you, having spoken about the treatments, to tell us a little bit more about the idea of targeting and how we implemented it in this setting?
That sounds good, Simon. Maybe before we get to the targeting, though, let me chat a little bit more about this adaptivity that I started out with. Right, so Stefano now described, like, we had these like three different interventions, and then there's also the control arm. And I talked about this idea, how you want to move over time towards the more successful treatments. And this is something that's known as exploiting the information that you have in the machine learning literature. But there is kind of a tension there between exploitation and exploration, which is kind of the other objective. Exploration, meaning that you keep experimenting in order to actually learn more precisely what is effective. But it's kind of the key challenge when you do this type of adaptive trial is to keep the two things in balance. Right? You might be greedy and just go all in, like something looked best in the beginning. Let's just only do that for the rest of time. But that might be a bad idea because you might just get stuck on something that was just randomly good in the beginning, but actually it's not such a good idea. Or you might be very conservative and slow and just keep experimenting, but then you're actually wasting the life chances of your participants. And so a key thing is like how fast you move from exploring towards exploiting what you've learned. And so that's one thing we put a lot of attention to here. And then the other thing, so you were mentioning targeting, but so here the idea is not everything might work for everybody in the same way, right? Maybe if you're an older woman with higher education, but no prior labor market experience who recently fled from Syria, the type of interventions that are useful for you might be quite different than if you're, say, like a young man who just dropped out of high school, who grew up in Jordan. So it's important to kind of figure out not only what's effective on average, but what's effective for whom. And the idea of targeting is that you learn what works for whom, and then actually give people the interventions that make sense for them. So that's kind of the second key innovation in our experimental design, that we're not only adapting over time towards the more successful interventions, but we are also targeting the interventions that make sense for different groups of participants. And to do that, there's kind of a key challenge, which is how do you combine information, right? So maybe you've never in your data before had like an older woman with higher education, but no prior labor market experience or something like that. But then you might like draw on information from other, maybe partially similar participants in the experiment. But then over time, you might have more and more information for different groups. And then you can just focus on learning from these groups specifically. And so that's again something that we implemented there. It's called like a Bayesian hierarchical model. But the basic idea is that you combine this information in optimal ways between the group that you're targeting and other groups that might be similar. Yeah, so that's in a nutshell kind of the idea of this experimental design. You're adapting over time to the better working interventions, you're targeting to the groups for which these interventions make sense. And now this might sound a little bit complicated or daunting if you're running an experiment yourself. But I want to emphasize at the end of the day, it's not that complicated. There's a little bit of tools and we provide like code and apps that if you want to run an experiment yourself of this style, you can just download and use. In the modern digital era, it's actually not too hard to implement an experiment like that, right? And then you would have in the field offices for case workers work with unemployed job seekers. They might have some tablet or smartphone where they can just look on a little app that decides for them what intervention to assign whom to. And then in the background, we can have a little program running that actually implements our adaptive targeting algorithm. And so that worked out surprisingly smoothly, I would say, and is actually, I think, quite adaptable to many different settings.
Thanks, Max. I remember very well the discussions in the research team that it was almost like logging in to check the scores of your favorite football team, that especially in the early days, we could actually see the assignment probabilities going up and down on a dashboard of sorts that I think you had kindly prepared. Can you tell us just a little bit more? Because I think the intuition is clear here, but the algorithm is handling all of the assignment probabilities, and then the algorithm is going to give assignment probabilities, and then what? And then the researcher then uses those to randomize, or indeed the code then just generates a randomization for somebody else who enters the program the next day, as it were. Is that a fair intuitive
exactly
summary?
So I mean, there's like the dashboard, right, that was in the back end for us to kind of follow what's going on, and it was super interesting on the level of the people in the field who are actually implementing this. They don't have to deal with any of that. They just go to this like little website or app where they just enter, here I have like a job seeker with these characteristics, and the app just spits out, give them like the information intervention or give them some cash to help them search for a job. Everything else is kind of run in the background by the program that kind of collects the data over time, how successful different interventions were. That's just collected in some spreadsheet somewhere. And then the program reads out the spreadsheet and based on that decides how to assign new participants in the program to different treatment arms.
One of the interesting things about doing this, I guess, in a labor market context is that you don't necessarily have to wait 6, 12, 18 months to know whether a policy is or isn't working. In this context, as you alluded to, we were able to have relatively quick return information on whether someone had found a job in the short term. And of course, that may mask longer term effects. Some treatments in some contexts may take a long time to materialize. But I guess the point is, in this case, we thought that that was going to be a pretty good proxy for people's longer term success under different treatments.
That's exactly right. So participants got a call, I think like 6 weeks or 2 months after participating in the program. And then they were just asked on the phone if they found a job. And then that's the key outcome that we're trying to maximize, is the probability of people finding a job a couple of months after participating. As you mentioned, that might be quite easy to implement in some settings and not easy to implement in other settings, right? So this type of method is used a lot in online settings, like when the big tech companies are maximizing ad clicks, right? That's like something where they get very quick feedback, like did somebody click on this link that we put it on the website or not? And so for that kind of situation, it's very easy to adapt quickly and efficiently. But then there might be other settings where it takes a long time for outcomes to realize, right? So taking medicine again as an example, I think like typical interventions that would affect Alzheimer's risk, that might take like 30, 40 years for any results to be seen. And in that kind of setting, it would not be very useful to think about adaptive methods because you won't have outcomes that quickly. But I think a lot of like the type of policies you might be interested in the labor market or development economics context, actually you would know fairly quickly within the time frame of an experiment whether something was effective. And as long as you have observed outcomes for some people before the end of the experiment, then you have information that you can use in order to take better care of your participants. And again, like I want to emphasize the ethical dimension of that, right? Like not just seeing them as a means to an end, but seeing the participants as an end in themselves, where we're not just using them to learn for our academic papers or for our policy recommendations, but we're really trying to do right by them by giving them the interventions that are most helpful to them.
I think one thing that I would add for the people who are listening is that I think one area where I expect this to be particularly applicable is experiments that you're running with large institutions that have a constant flow of clients. So for example, schools or hospitals or, I don't know, courts or things like that, where you basically have a fixed institution that serves a population that gets a service and then leaves. There are lots of them, and we do a lot of work with these kind of institutions. And in this case, you get both fast feedback and a constant stream of new people that would benefit from the adaptivity. So I just wanted to flag that in many of the settings where we work in as applied economists, actually, this would actually be a good match.
I think that's a great point, Stefano. And I think also fascinating that you raised the point of the partner institution. I think this dovetails nicely with Max's point about ethics. I would find it really difficult to go into a crisis situation where you've got, for example, a large NGO trying to help a target population and say, hi, can I do a long-term fixed proportion RCT and please don't do anything with the control group for 2 years because I need to write my paper. I don't think any researcher would feel comfortable with that. So I think this is where the ethical dimension that Max raises touches on the institutional dimension, that you can say to a policymaker, look, we're going to experiment, but we're going to do our very best to move respondents towards treatments that seem to be helping them, and not just helping on average, but as Max explained, helping for the particular kind of respondent that they are.
I think that's a great point. In particular, oftentimes I think when you run RCTs in kind of the more classic way, right, then you have this tension between like an implementation partner organization and the researchers. And the implementation partners, they often believe they know what works best. They believe they have like a mandate to help the clients. Their goal is not to do research, right? And then you have the researchers who want to write academic papers with like precisely estimated treatment effect. And those are two different goals. And so I think what this toolkit of like adaptive experiments, like we are contributing to here, what that allows you to do is like align more closely the objectives of the experimenters and the objectives of implementation partners. And in our case here, right, if the International Rescue Committee said our goal is to help refugees find jobs quickly, you can say that's our goal too, and we are designing our experiment to help refugees find jobs quickly. There is no conflict here, and so you should be happy to let us do the experiment because we are actually just helping you to fulfill your mission, as opposed to kind of being in attention with what you're trying to achieve. And so that might actually also open all kinds of new sites and venues where you could run experiments where like a plastic RCT might be unethical, but also politically unfeasible.
I completely agree. In a minute, I want to ask Stefano to actually tell us about the results. Before I do that, let me pose one more question to you, Max, and I might make friends and enemies in the world of Bayesian statistics here, but I want to throw in a slightly nerdy question. Suppose you're dealing with a policymaker who says, all right, I'll do this adaptive RCT, but I have a very strong belief that treatment one is going to work and treatment two is not. Some people would say, we should use that prior belief and we should use it to, if you like, seed the model. So we're going to start by putting a lot more people into the treatment arm, reflective not of data that we've collected in the experiment, but reflecting the strong prior that the policymaker has. Other people would say, no, it's interesting. It's important that the policymaker feels they know what works, but we should start with a much less informative prior, to use the terminology, and let the experiment and the data tell us what's working. I know there are different views out there about this. In our context, we collected information about what policymakers thought, but we didn't feed that information directly into the algorithm. Max, I'm just keen to draw you out just for a few more minutes on your thoughts about the respective pros and cons of those approaches.
So I think that makes perfect sense, right? If policymakers, partners, and clients for that matter, often have a lot of information about what might work or might not work. Right. So we learned that, for instance, in our experiment by running some focus groups with refugees, and they had very strong opinions about the interventions, which largely line up with what we found later in the experiment. And so that kind of information can be very useful for designing the experiment. And as you say, like if we have a strong belief beforehand that some intervention is more effective, then makes a lot of sense for that intervention to get a larger share for the observation or for a large share of participants to get assigned to that intervention. And I think it's very important to keep two things separate here. One is how you run the experiment, right? You might put a lot of people in like the information intervention and less people in the nudge intervention or something like that. But that doesn't prevent you from after the fact analyzing the experiment in a way where your analysis doesn't draw on that prior at all. Right. So if you just want to have like a scientific evaluation that only depends on the data and does not draw on the policymaker or partner or a client beliefs, that's perfectly fine. You can do that even if you run an experiment where you use those policymaker or partner beliefs in order to decide which treatment assigned more often.
Understood. Thanks, Max. I feel like we've been teasing our listeners for a while now with the discussion of the actual results. Let me go back to you, Stefano. Why don't you tell us what we think we learned in this context about the constraints that refugees face in urban labor markets and how we think that might be relevant for other kinds of policy interventions in similar settings in future?
Thank you, Simon. So I guess maybe I'll talk about treatment effects, but perhaps let me say a couple of words about the population that we are working with, just to set this in context. So our key population of interest here was a population of Syrian refugees found in three cities around Jordan. This was a population that perhaps in Syria was not necessarily particularly poor, but wasn't doing very well in Jordan. So employment rates were extremely low, and so were incomes. So people were very close to the poverty line, many of them below the poverty line. And there was quite a bit of interesting work and quite a bit of work experience as well, but very little, at least formal employment. We know that some people were working informally, although they were not necessarily very comfortable sharing that as it would break the law. And so given that they're quite vulnerable as refugees, this was something that they weren't really forthcoming in discussing with us. Now, we then offered these three interventions. We offered these interventions both to the Syrian refugees, that they were the kind of central population in our study, but also to a second population of local Jordanians. This is actually quite important for two reasons. One, because we want to see whether the same interventions, whether the constraints that prevent these two populations from accessing the labor markets are similar or whether they need different policies. And two, going back to ethics, it's a very important commitment of IRC to always match the support that they give to the population that a given country is hosting to an equivalent amount of support given to other national individuals living in the same areas that are also struggling to, in this case, find employment. So it's a kind of prerequisite for IRC to do this kind of equitable policy allocation to avoid generating resentment and the perception that refugees are favored. So our study also including a second population of national Jordanians. Now, what did we find? We interviewed individuals 6 weeks after treatment, then 2 and 4 months after treatment. So we have 3 points in time in which we can observe outcomes. 6 weeks after treatments, it was too soon. We found that there were minimal effects on employment for all groups. 2 and 4 months after treatment, we found that the cash intervention in particular increased the job search, and then in turn, employment and earnings. Now, the type of treatment effect that we're talking about, this is close to a 4 percentage point increase in employment, which we should put in context in at least two ways. Number one, 4 percentage point is not huge. This is clearly not transformational. In a sense, these are light touch interventions, so perhaps we shouldn't expect them to have transformational effects. We're basically getting the employment rates from about 9% to about 13%. So this is it's still a population that is fairly locked out of the labor market. However, in relative terms, there's a fairly large increase in employment. So it's almost 50% increase. And also relative to the kind of treatment effects that we found in the active labor market policy literature, the search literature that has tried to devise similar policies in other contexts in the world, it's actually in line with what people found elsewhere. In fact, it's towards the upper part of the distribution of treatment effects. Same story for the treatment effects on income. We found that income goes up by almost 60%. The absolute amount is limited in a sense because we're starting from a very low base. In relative terms, this is a large effect. One more thing that I want to say about the cash intervention is that this is one of the few, in fact, one of two unconditional cash interventions that are designed to boost search. There are other papers in this literature that show that if you gave people conditional cash, for example, basically vouchers that enable people to take transport and travel to the center of town, those interventions boosted job search. But it wasn't clear whether that was the case because you were kind of almost forcing people search for work in order to benefit from the intervention, or whether people would have increased their job search given some additional resources, whether this was something that was very high in their priority, they were not doing extra investment in job search because of the lack of cash. So it's quite interesting that we find that giving this unconditional cash among Syrians does raise job search quite a bit, and then this leads to employment. Among Jordanians, on the other hand, who are this is still a fairly poor population, but they're richer than the Syrians, they find job at faster rates, they're generally better off. We actually find that cash has very limited effects. The other two interventions, the information and the nudge interventions, also increase job search, less so than the cash intervention. And they do lead to some employment effects at the two-month mark, but these effects are smaller and less persistent. So by the time of the four-month interview, we see positive coefficients, but smaller and generally statistically insignificant. So these are other two interventions, although they seem to have at least activated some job search and generated some gains, they proved less effective.
Thanks, Stefan. I mean, it's a really interesting summary. This issue of how you help displace people in urban labor markets is sadly not an issue that's going away. So the takeaway for a policy setting for future crises is that when we think about cash support for refugees or displaced populations, that this is not only valuable intrinsically in terms of increasing welfare, but we should actually think of this as unlocking search capacity in potentially new labor markets. Is that a fair takeaway? I know as researchers, we always struggle to think about how to generalize our results to other contexts, but it feels to me like that's a sort of insight that we gain from this population that may be relevant for future crises.
Absolutely. So I would say that basically one important takeaway, of course, if you generalize to different crises, other things will change, but it's probably true overall that refugees typically lose a lot of assets during the process of displacement. So this is a population where a little bit of cash can have very high returns. The point stands that also in our population, employment rates and incomes remain quite low. So it's not going to be by any means a sufficient intervention, but it's probably a small but high return thing that one can do, help refugees operate in the new labor markets. There is one more thing that I want to say, which is, of course, there are many things that would differ when you compare different refugee crises. But I think one factor that is of essential importance is language. And so some refugee crises, for example, the one experienced by Jordan or Lebanon, you find that refugees are coming to a country speaking effectively the language that is spoken in the country, maybe a different dialect, maybe they have a bit of an accent. But by and large, they're already able to communicate with pretty much anybody in the host country. Syrian refugees going to Turkey, for example, we're in a very different position. And in fact, in Turkey, we find that they tend to mostly work in self-employment and keep trading with Syrians living elsewhere in the world rather than getting integrated in the local economy like the Jordanian and Lebanese policymakers were trying to do. I'm not entirely sure which of the two kinds of shocks is more common. For example, Venezuelans going to Colombia, they spoke the same language, a different accent, but same language. Lots of other refugees crises, some of those in Eastern Africa, for example, you find populations that are really, and those in Europe in many cases, in fact, refugees based in Europe, very often language is the first barrier. So I would say that in cases where language is also an issue, I'm not entirely sure this results will generalize simply because refugees may not be immediately employable before they pick up the essential language skills.
I think that's a really excellent point. And let me loop back to a point that Max made earlier, which is that we did a bunch of qualitative work, of course, talking to this population. And this narrative about the importance of cash for unlocking search was certainly one that seemed to resonate with a lot of the refugee respondents themselves, which I think is interesting and maybe also something that would be useful in terms of learning in other contexts exactly about the practicalities that you talk about. Well, I've really enjoyed this conversation. It's brought back a lot of fond memories of a project that I really enjoyed doing and where I certainly learned a lot. Thanks very much, Stefano and Max, and thanks to all of our listeners for tuning in. I'm certainly very keen to see how these two different literatures go, to see where people think about new interventions to help these kind of vulnerable displaced populations, and also to see the emerging field of adaptive and targeted field experiments. Thanks, everyone.
Very exciting, likewise. Thank you, Simon.
Thank you so much, Simon. Thank you, Stefano. Thanks.